Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the Indian Religions podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and I have today a very special guest for you, Dr. Don Davis. He's professor and chair at the Department of Asian Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Raj.
So we are going to speak about a really interesting and important development at the University of Austin. It's a resource for the study of Dharma Shastra texts. Tom, why don't you tell us a bit about this resource?
Sure. So we've called it the Resource Library for Dharma Shastra Studies, and it sort of came together in its current form very recently over the summer of 2021 as a series of links to electronic texts of important commentaries and digests of the Dharmashastra tradition. But it has its origins somewhat earlier in the efforts of the small group of Dharmashastra scholars around the world to enhance and improve and then share various kinds of resources related to the study of Dharmashastra and Hindu law.
Can you say a quick word about Dharmashastra?
Of course, yeah. So the Dharmashastra tradition, as many listeners may know, is a very old tradition, probably dating back to the 3rd century BCE or so, beginning with the Dharma Sutra literature. It is a specialized or expert tradition carried on by Brahminical scholars, almost exclusively in Sanskrit, that continued up through the contemporary period in various ways. It was a living tradition all the way through the colonial period, and then under British colonialism experienced dramatic changes, but nevertheless persisted in a kind of modified form because of the great interest that the British took in the Dharmashastras as some kind of reflection of, or even in their misunderstanding, a kind of reality of law on the ground in India. And so the tradition that came to be known as Hindu law or Anglo-Hindu law, which has then morphed into what we call modern Hindu law under the Indian Constitution, has its distant origins in the Dharmashastra literature and the Dharmashastra jurisprudence, we might say, or ways of thinking about law. Dharmashastra as a genre, of course, is one large or influential piece of the larger category of smriti in Sanskrit traditions, literally that which is remembered, but largely covering what might be generally called traditional texts, including your own beloved Puranas, but also other texts like sometimes the epics are sort of included in that list, as well as various vidyasthanas or sources of knowledge that kind of roughly fit into the category of capturing the traditions of the Hindu world or the Brahmanical world. And within that, though, I have argued over the years that Dharmashastra has had an outsized presence, let's say, within the smriti genre. as being in some ways the preeminent sub form of Smriti literature.
And so when we're looking at the body of Dharmashastras, can you give listeners a sense of how much of that, or perhaps how many texts comprise the online resource?
Right. It is a daunting number of texts because, of course, we've lost access to many to which we have reference in various places. The earliest strata of the Dharmashastra tradition, called the Dharma Sutra tradition, consists of four major Dharma Sutras, Apastamba, Gautama, Baudhayana, and Vasishta. And these texts then yielded in some ways, both in form and in some ways in content, to an expanding horizon of topics and themes that were incorporated in this tradition with the compilation of a very famous text known as the Manusmriti, or the Man of a Dharmashastra, probably in the early centuries CE or AD. And that text, which we loosely call Manu, really changed the game in the tradition of Dharmashastra. And at that moment, then we have the next strata of Dharmashastra that we often call the Dharmashastras proper, also known as the Mula Smritis, for a reason that we can discuss in a moment, the root texts. And these are essentially the core texts that gather together information ranging from household rituals, marriage, daily rites, anything relating to how you eat, how you comport yourself, to then much more specifically legal matters like adoption, inheritance, commercial matters of all sorts, buying and selling and so forth, but then criminal issues as well, theft and slander and assault, these sorts of things. And then finally, including issues related to what's called in Sanskrit prayaschitta, expiation or some kind of penance that's used to correct mistakes that one makes in life and so forth. So the range of what Dharmashastra included expanded dramatically over time. And the next indication of that is with the next strata of Dharmashastra literature comprised of two different sorts of texts. One is called the commentaries, the bhashyas or tikas, and one is called the digests or the nibandhas. And these two genres, again, expanded the scope of Dharmashastra to include things that would have been more common in texts like the Puranas, things about puja, things about, so temple rituals, right? Things then about pilgrimage, which had been a rather small topic in earlier literature, now become the subject of huge digests. And the Purana literature itself then is cited extensively in these later strata of Dharmashastra as a new resource for the evolution of the Dharmashastra tradition. So I think what one sees is that as the Hindu tradition itself evolves and changes, so also does the Dharmashastra reflect those changes, usually at a kind of delay, it appears. But it is a truly fascinating genre because of the insight that it can provide into the social history of India. So even though religion scholars have long found important resources in this tradition, people who are interested in history and social issues and so forth also should be finding very important information in this tradition, and you can begin to see developments and changes in that as well.
You actually preempted my subsequent question at the end of that answer, which is, you know, who's this for? Who can benefit from this this online resource? Certainly scholars of Hinduism, especially scholars of the Dharmashastra literature, but also perhaps continue along the lines you were just talking about.
Sure. So I want to acknowledge, first of all, that the very idea of putting together electronic texts of this sort, of essentially transcribing Devanagari editions of various texts into Roman versions in order, you know, Roman script versions in order to facilitate searching, originated back in the late 1980s and 90s with a kind of similar project coming out of Japan. And those scholars, of course, are very famous for, you know, giving us the Mahabharata and Ramayana that we all rely on. But they also produced editions of these Mula Smritis that I mentioned before. And the purpose of our resource library is to enhance or to put out the next layer of information sort of related to Dharmashastra, namely those commentaries and digests that I mentioned before. So we didn't have electronic versions of those texts available for searching and for research until now. And that's, I think, the great contribution of the electronic texts that are available now. So to get to your question then, the reason that we've been focusing on those medieval texts that probably start sometime maybe 7th, 8th century CE, and then continue on through the British colonial period, is precisely that you have commentators who are struggling to understand what the texts mean, how they should be interpreted, and they are unable to, you know, live completely in their in a kind of isolated world of Sanskrit,
intellectualizing.
Yeah, you know, where they're only focused on the tradition, and so careful reading of the text often yields insights into prevailing practices that might have been existing at the time. A famous example of that is, it's not coincidental that a few of the texts of the Dharmashastra texts from this period in South India put in a defense for the practice of cross cousin marriage, which is of course a prevalent marital pattern in South India, Tamil Nadu, and you know other parts of South India. So you can see immediately why. These defenses, whether it's Madhava or Devanabhatta or whoever it might be, is putting in a defense for cross-cousin marriage. It's because they know it in practice, even though it's either dismissed or not approved in some earlier texts. And so there's a lot of wonderful creative reformulation of the old texts in the exegesis of those authors.
So you mentioned in passing the utility of having these texts in electronic format for searching, and folks like you and I know exactly what that means, but can you expand upon that? What do you mean by that?
Sure. Yeah. So the if you can imagine, if you have a text that consists of, you know, so I'll give you an example, the famous commentary by the author Medhatiti, probably a Kashmir author, maybe 9th century CE. Medhatiti's commentary in modern printed form, it runs to close to something like 800 pages and, you know, it's two massive volumes. And if you are searching a particular topic or if you are researching a particular topic, in order to find out all the places that just this one author, Medhatiti, might refer to an issue, you have to really put in an incredible amount of work just to review and cover that material. So if you are, if you have access rather to an electronic version, what you can do is highlight the keywords that you might be looking for that are related to your research area. So if I'm, I'll give you an example because I think some of the best work in this area has been done by my friend and colleague, David Brick, now at the University of Michigan. And one of the things that David has been able to do in recent years is produce a series of really excellent studies, in part using the electronic editions that have been available, but of course his own, he's looking at things beyond that too. But if he's looking for a word like, or he's been putting out studies, for example, on sati or sahagamana, the controversial practice of widow immolation in India, which generated so much controversy in the British period. And he was trying to provide a history of how that practice was treated in the Dharmashastra literature. That work is facilitated tremendously by being able to literally search the word sati or sahagamana or other related terms that are connected with this practice. And from that, he was able to discern, or rather pinpoint, moments and likely periods of time within which attitudes towards this practice shifted in remarkable ways, and gives us a much more nuanced intellectual history of how this practice was treated, both positively and negatively in earlier times. And so it's that kind of explosion of capacity that's enabled through the electronic versions. So I think all of us now are shifting more as more and more electronic texts become available. We're simply able to much more quickly glean a sense of which authors have talked about this issue, find those places in the text where the issues are discussed, and then hopefully competently and fairly put them together in some kind of analytical framework that we've been working on.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Certainly is a powerful research tool with a simple control F or whatever your operating system requires. You can see at a glance the density of a certain term, whether it's placed in certain chapters, certain texts, quite useful. Not to mention good old copy and pasting for your manuscript.
Absolutely, yeah. But there's a funny example of this that I would like to share, which is
of course
the main input, the prime mover behind this project, as in many cases in my life, ended up being my mentor and now friend and colleague Patrick Olivelle, who when he was producing his award-winning book, The Ashrama System, was trying to locate all the instances of the word ashrama in various texts. And this was just prior, unfortunately, to the existence of the electronic Mahabharata and Ramayana texts. And so Patrick, in his indefatigable way, managed to scan, that is to say, read the entire Mahabharata and Ramayana in the critical editions in order to find the one place, literally, where ashrama occurs in the Ramayana. And this kind of work, I think, is now unnecessary, thanks to the glories of the electronic text.
The definition of tapasya.
Yes, and wonderful tapasya.
And it's borne fruit for sure. So what's the process whereby this resource is generated? Like, how does it work?
Sure. This particular project began with an idea that I had about 5 years ago to transcribe a text that I had been working on, the Mitakshara of Vijnaneshwara, probably the most influential of the commentaries on in Dharmashastra generally. It's a commentary on an older text called the Yajnavalkya Smriti. And this text is, was important enough that I thought an e-version of it would be really great. And so I started transcribing things and found myself, oh boy, this is taking some time. And, I'm feeling compelled to check this and that. And so I enlisted the help of some graduate students in our department because I was fortunate enough to have some funding. And so with the help of two graduate students, Amy Hines Sutherland and Nicola Ryich, over the period of about 2 years or so, we were able to transcribe the entirety of that commentary, the Mitakshara. This was back in about 2017 when that text was kind of finished. And we didn't release it with any fanfare at the time because I knew, having reviewed it, that there were still quite a lot of errors and still, you know, I mean, everybody who does kind of transcription work just, you know, not on purpose, of course, but just makes typos like any good scribe would. And so we didn't have time to check it all, and we felt, oh, it's premature to release it. And eventually, though, Patrick Olivelle got interested in, let's just move this forward. And so he spent some time proofreading that transcription. And I'm very happy that he did, because what happened is he got the bug. And he decided that this was actually a very worthy project. So initially, then, we had planned to put up all of our transcriptions on one of the more centralized repositories for text, like Gretl, the Göttingen repository for text in Indian languages, where many of us draw our resources. Unfortunately, Patrick and myself are technologically incapable of sort of producing the kinds of works that they would like to see either at Gretl or at Saret, the other repository that's out there, because those groups use text encoding initiative standards and other kinds of things that we felt were beyond our ken. And so what we decided to do in the end was just kind of start working on things in-house a little bit. And we latched on to the idea that's becoming more and more popular now, Open Educational Resources, OER. And we decided that if we release our versions as OER, then somebody at Gretl or somebody at Saret, if they want to manipulate or improve our version, it's perfectly fine for them to do that. And they can enhance anything that we work on. But we don't have to have any delay between finishing the initial transcription and releasing it to the public for initial use. We know full well that there are still errors in everything that we have put out into the public domain at this point. Nevertheless, we think the existence of, you know, a few hundred typos in a volume of 800 pages is worth the problem. And so what happens these days now is that the work that the three of us did over the period of 2 years, Professor Olivelle has decided that he can do all of that work essentially by himself. so he's a workhorse. There's no doubt about it. And he's famous for that within the field. But it's one of the weird blessings of the COVID pandemic that Professor Olivelle's isolation and all the forced isolation that all of us have had to deal with has led him to just, you know, put up a text next to him while he's, relaxing and kind of type things in as he goes. And because he reads the text so quickly and follows things, he's able to do it quite rapidly. So basically, over the last year and a half since the pandemic first hit, I have received something on the order of 3,000 printed pages in transcription from him that are now posted. So the 500 pages that the three of us were able to do, he has been able to produce sixfold in somewhat less time, which, you know, it shames us in an appropriate way, but also sets a standard that others may not be able to quite live up to. So what happens now, and I'm happy to say, Raj, it literally happened this morning, I got the first transcription of the Dayabhaga of Jimutavahana from Professor Olivelle this morning. He sends them to me in Word. I convert the document into a Google Doc, and then we post it. And it's as simple as that. We take a simple Word document because he prefers to work in Microsoft Word. That's not a very friendly version to share with the world. So Google Docs, although it has its own issues, is perfectly usable. Anybody can kind of access it and see it with minimal sort of special software and whatnot. And and then what we do is we share that document with a small group of Dharmashastra scholars who then have editing privileges. And then as and when we have time, or if we're working on particular sections, we try to fix errors of transcription that we notice in the text. So that's the basic process, is we just sort of put the Google Doc out there for everybody to use.
So in terms of man versus machine, apparently Dr. Olivelle is the exception where he can work faster than the machine.
Yes, and I think he's, you know, proving the value of the human machine once again.
As much as I would innately appreciate this work, I appreciate it all the more because I made the mistake of in my second book, The Goddess and the Sun, I was fascinated by the sun myths in the Makani Purana. I made the mistake of putting in sort of a bonus appendix to the Sanskrit text. And I take full responsibility. I was under the impression that the appendix was part of the review process on behalf of the publisher. And they were under the impression that it was fine as it is. They're only looking at it. And so there are no shortages of misprints and typos and things. I mean, I personally think it's still obviously quite valuable to have most of the text there for for reference purposes.
Right.
but nevertheless, you know, editing such a thing, there's only one Patrick Olivelle in the world, right?
So well, that's right. Well, and the only reason that I still consider him mortal and human is because when I do read these transcriptions, I'm pleased to report that there are errors. There are, in fact, mistakes. And I'm working...
Does he blink, sweat, or...
No, his feet don't touch the ground. Yeah, his feet don't touch the ground. So...
We'll have to have him on the podcast at some point. Actually, maybe not. Let him just continue working on what he's working on.
Yeah, don't bother him. He's working.
That's fantastic. In addition to how valuable a resource this is, obviously, for anyone studying or interested in the Dharma Shastras, it's timely, right? I mean, it's participating in this this online Wild West that we're all mapping out together. It's also part of this transformation of open access, right? Folks can have access to this anywhere they have the internet, essentially, which is fantastic. Do you have a sense of the future of the project, or do you have plans for further texts or its management, its dissemination? I mean, just tell me a bit about the vision of the project.
Sure. I mean, I think in the short term, we are content to simply keep trying to input more, you know, transcribe more texts that haven't been transcribed to make them available, and to continue working, especially on texts that we consider important and valuable for one reason or another, and making sure that a wider scholarly audience can make use of those in this format. Or, as I mentioned before, take them and make them improve them somehow, use them as the basis for their own research or their own manipulations into a more pukka or developed format. So the vision that we have for the resource library in general is that, you know, we will continue to add texts as best we can. We're going to do our best to try to solicit the help of friendly colleagues, but also compensated students, we hope, to proofread and make sure that these texts are as accurate as possible. And we've been doing that with the Smriti Chandrika over the summer with a small cooperative help from the University of Virginia and a woman named Elliot Davenport, who is on the precipice of completing the proofreading for the 5 volumes of the Smriti Chandrika, a very important digest of the Dharmashastra tradition from South India. And that kind of model will be one that we want to follow later on to ensure that what we're doing is not only providing the substance, but also the accuracy that we would like to see there in the final proofread versions of text. So that's the main thing that we hope to do. But at the same time, I think that we have other projects that could, we've been tossing around other ideas, at least around things that we could add in there. It's one thing to be able to put the text out there. It's another thing, if you're a relatively new student, to learn how to read them. And so one idea that I've been trying to work with Dr. Olivelle on is to maybe get him to provide primers of how to read these darn things to make sure that people can understand the sometimes complex structure and language of commentarial Sanskrit in particular, and to give people who are new to the genre or new to the Sanskrit style of Shastra some insights into how to read these texts or what kinds of additional training one might like to have before approaching them. And I have in mind here some understanding of the Mimamsa tradition and how Mimamsa's hierarchical understanding of language and hermeneutics really affects and is embedded within the Dharmashastra approach to understanding earlier Vedic and Smriti texts. So I hope that in addition to substantive resources, we'll have complementary tools or trainings or something like that, where either in written form or perhaps in a video type form, we could have explanations of how to read these texts, maybe with examples where we're taken through the text by Dr. Olivelle or someone else.
I imagine that would be very attractive for a potential new generation of Indological scholars remotely interested in these texts, because it would be a great on-ramp, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think like everybody, we're just trying to build our field because we believe in the value of this genre to yield insights that all of us are searching for, to understand the beauty and integrity of the ancient Sanskrit traditions, and but also to develop enough awareness of the traditions to be critical of them too, to sort of say, oh wow, look at the attitudes expressed in this text, or look at the complicated and problematic attitudes expressed in that text. And one can't do that without a really solid foundation and a really thorough exposure to the entirety of the tradition. And so one thing that I really think will be enhanced is our ability to see the relationships between debates and controversies and issues as they were discussed in the Dharmashastra tradition that then became so important for the colonial and now post-colonial worlds in India, so that we can understand how things have evolved and developed, perhaps both for the good and the bad. And to be honest about that with ourselves and with each other.
I think that's an important point, particularly for a broader audience who might be interested in these texts or these ideas. The point being that the dynamism, the change, the conversation, rather than going back to a finite text or source or authority, it's being granted access to a very complicated conversation, a process that... depending on how you look at it, a process that we can still engage in today in terms of these values and ideas about governance.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Was there anything else about this resource that you wanted to share today?
I don't think so, Raj. I think this we've covered it pretty well. I mean, the only other thing I guess I could mention is that the resource library does include a fairly extensive annotated bibliography of works related to Dharmashastra that I had compiled quite a number of years ago based on printed bibliographies that had been done in the field before, mostly in the 60s and 70s. And we tried to enhance that with references to more recent stuff. But I've been trying to revivify that bibliography, and it's called the Cooperative Annotated Bibliography of Hindu Law and Dharmashastra. And that cooperative bit is the piece where, if anybody listening would like to help me work on that, I would appreciate that help.
Fantastic. I'm glad we touched on that. I had in mind something in the back of my brain. There's apparently a lot of space back there. Because many of that which is conceived is born into the world, and there's much yet to be born. But something comparable for Puranas, some you know, some sort of, you know, the Piranha Project, right? It would be massive. It would take a generation.
But the people are there. You know, I think that there's a, you know, there's a strong group of Purana scholars out there, and I think it's the kind of thing that could be done. And what I like about the way that things have evolved, and why I really have been attracted to the OER, Open Educational Resource model, is that especially for people like myself who are established professionally, and are no longer constrained in a sense by the anxieties around tenure, you know, getting a job and getting tenure and those kinds of things, which are real considerations. The OER model frees you up to still retain, you know, sort of authorship and recognition for the contribution that you have made, but not to put it behind a wall that disallows other people from enhancing and improving it. So for this kind of resource, I think it's really a wonderful model that can be used or replicated in other areas. And I think that the level of technological skill that one needs to have to produce what we have done, as I hope listeners understood, is very low. And one can do this pretty simply if you just have access to a university server and, you know, can get these things up on a website somewhere. So I guess I would end by just saying that, you know, the OER model is one that I think has proven its value through this project and others like it. And that, you know, I anticipate down the road that it will receive increasing professional recognition and in a sense count in that way that people need it to for their own professional development. So it's I'll put in my plug for OER at the end.
That's a fantastic note to end on. We have a podcast coming out around the same time as this one, maybe just before actually, with Dominic Haas about open access resources in our field and the future of that and what that could look like. So fascinating and important work. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today to share it with us.
My pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity to let a wider audience know about the project. We're always looking for help.
Fantastic. For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Donald Davis, who's professor and chair at the Department of Asian Studies at the University of Texas Austin. We've been speaking with him about this really cool, new, important resource, this online resource. It's a resource library for Dharmashastra studies. The link to the actual resource will be in the podcast notes. Until then, keep listening, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating online Indological resources. Take care.